Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 2nd. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first article, top of the fold, front page, RTP becoming ground zero for crop science. This is by Lauren K. Onisorge and is from the Research Triangle Park. As demand for food increases, science is taking a big bet on genetic modification as a way to increase crop yields and accommodate a future population boom. At the center of that future is Research Triangle Park, a fact bolstered by a series of recent multi-million dollar investments by big park players. Most recently, Syngenta Biotechnology announced a 150-job, $94 million expansion of its RTP campus, fueling the idea that one day RTP and agribiotech will be synonymous. It's something local leaders have recognized for a while. Leaders such as Syngenta site lead Bill Havelak, who has been pushing his Swiss biotech bosses to undertake such an expansion for nearly 5 years. Generally speaking, the government support that we've gotten has really demonstrated to our leadership in Switzerland that this was the right environment, he says. But it's been slow going. Just as North Carolina faces continual competition for company relocations from the likes of California and Texas, the RTP campus faces competition from other Syngenta sites. In this case, it was among RTP and sites in Minnesota, Iowa, and Brazil. While the final decision came with a state incentive package valued at $2.98 million, the area's quality of life, coupled a rich talent pool, were deciding factors, and each new investment further bolsters Havelak's argument. The recent investment allows him to create a collaborative environment with buildings specifically planned to drive interaction with open office space. Specifically, the expansion complements the company's new advanced crop lab, which has 200,000 square feet of laboratory and office space. This new facility will bring our employees together in one location, furthering our ability to work collaboratively on crop trait discovery and development that brings growers the tools they need to improve plant performance in any environment, says Michael von Lukeren, campaign, president of Syngenta Biotechnology. And it might not be the last expansion here. The walls of the new building, just like the recently completed greenhouse laboratory facility to which it will connect, are designed to facilitate further growth. If at any point, like we're doing now, we decide to expand, we've designed those walls to literally come down and accept the next phase, he says. Expansion is becoming the status quo for agribiotech and not just at Syngenta. Bayer Crop Science, led by CEO Jim Bloom, has also been expanding, having recently completed a greenhouse laboratory of its own here. The company also just broke ground on a new bee research facility and chose RTP for many of the same reasons. Quality of life and access to talent. Agribiotech companies choose to keep investing in RTP because of the socioeconomic and cultural richness of the region, explains Bloom. Since agriculture is the number one industry in North Carolina, the state possesses the resources necessary to help these companies grow and flourish. Add in the proximity of the universities, and it's an enticing environment for agribiotech, he adds. At Bayer Crop Science, we are considering quite a lot of investment expansion here, over the next 5 to 10 years especially, he says. We are basically doubling our investment in research and development. And German chemical giant BASF is also answering RTP's call. Having had a campus here since 1986, BASF made the decision last year to move both its biotechnology operations and its plant science division to the park. Nigel Arms, Director of Research and Development Operations and Site Services at BASF, says BASF has evolved alongside its competitors. He points to how, initially, agriculture chemical companies landed in the park. They started the same route, he explains. Over time, we moved in the direction of agribiotechnology. and that RTP shift felt across several companies attracted more innovation, particularly in the form of new players entering the space, many from the universities. And while there are other innovation-rich areas, they can't boast of RTP's evolution. It's really hard to compete now with what's happening in RTP, Arms says. As the world's population grows, players in RTP are expanding their search for solutions to hunger, and that takes dollars and cents. Recent solutions include Syngenta's AgriSure Duracade, researched in the park. The genetically modified corn seed helps farmers battle rootworm, improving yields, the company says. But as investments increase, so does the controversy surrounding genetically modified food. For their part, at least, RTP leaders aren't concerned with the naysayers. While they have protest signs, we have data, Havlek says. This week's cover story is North Carolina Strict on Nurses by Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. Nurse training has become such a deep dive into the science that one group of practitioners, advanced practice registered nurses, are equipped to undertake many of the same tasks as medical doctors. Yet, in North Carolina, they are barred from independently doing so in many cases. That's because the state is among the strictest in the nation in regulating what advanced practice registered nurses can and cannot do. This, says nurses, has repercussions beyond their field. It limits access to care, stifles entrepreneurship, and contributes to higher health care costs. In this state, nurse practitioners may open an independent practice, but unlike in most states, they are governed by both a nursing board and a medical board, which also regulates medical doctors, and must have a supervising physician sign off on many aspects of care. Along with six other states, North Carolina ranks as a Category 5, the most restrictive, by a research group that analyzed every state's regulations on nurse practitioners. What follows is a list of the Category 5 states that are most restrictive on what tasks nurse practitioners can undertake, followed by a Category 4 based on regulations and laws in 2010. Following are states in Category 5: Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, Missouri, North Carolina, and South Carolina. The remaining list are the least restrictive. These are Category 1 states: Alaska, Arizona, Colorado, District of Columbia, Maine, Maryland, Montana, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Oregon, Rhode Island, Washington, and Wyoming. Continuing on, in this case, the term more restrictive means that nurse practitioners are more likely to require physician supervision to provide medical care instead of having autonomy in areas such as writing prescriptions, making diagnosis, ordering tests, or making referrals. The project that led to the findings was headed by Yongfang Kyo, a professor of preventive medicine and community health at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas. It was published in Health Affairs, a medical journal. Typically, nurse practitioners must pay a fee for physician oversight, an invoice that comes to an average of $1,500 per month, says Bobby Lowry, a member of the North Carolina Board of Nursing and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Degree Program at East Carolina University. Deborah Varnum owns Varnum Family Wellness Center, is the Region 4 Director for the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, and is a lecturer at UNC Wilmington. She lays out the constraints that the requirement of having a supervising physician puts on her practice. She says that she's been in healthcare a long time. If she's stumped by something, she first talks with the other nurses and researches through all of the same resources as would a doctor. By the time she would bring the question to a supervising physician, it's likely that doctor wouldn't know either, so they end up calling a specialist, just as a practicing doctor might. The need for physician oversight just costs money, she says. It doesn't really provide or a benefit to me or as a healthcare provider or to the patients. Nurses nearly unanimously say that one of the major barriers to relaxing restrictions on their work are medical doctors, who want to keep the status quo. The North Carolina Medical Board, which regulates the practice of medicine in the state, argues that the current regulations are best for patient safety. To the board, the issue is cut and dry. Anyone performing medical acts is engaged in the practice of medicine, and anyone engaging in medicine should go to medical school, complete a residency, and achieve the proper licensure, says Jean Fisher Brinkley, a representative of the board. The board holds a basic patient safety position, she says. As for supervision of nurse practitioners, Brinkley argues that the board does not view the existing regulations as overly burdensome. A supervising physician is not required to be on site, and in many cases the doctor establishes a good relationship with the nurse practitioner and trusts the nurse's judgment, making it a simple process to approve prescriptions, referrals, and the like. In response, nurses argue that advances in medical science have allowed nurse practitioners to become as qualified for the services they want to provide as many primary care physicians. They point out that nurse practitioners do not want to practice above their level of training or certification, but they do want to provide those primary care services, including family medicine and pediatrics, in which many of the patients have simple issues such as allergies, seasonal cold, and the like. If a patient with a more severe medical issue walks through the doors of a nurse practitioner's office, the nurse would refer that patient to a specialist or other appropriate care, says Leslie Sharp, chairwoman of the Council of Nurse Practitioners, part of the North Carolina Nurses Association, and clinical instructor at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Nursing. We're not trying to practice beyond our scope of practice, says Sharp. We just want to practice within our full scope. An example that nurses often bring up is the act of taking blood pressure. Years ago, only a doctor was allowed to measure blood pressure, but that is, of course, now commonly performed by low-level hospital or office staff. By 2013, there are many other such healthcare-associated tasks that nurse practitioners are well qualified to handle, says Sharp. The medical board acknowledges that point, but still sees reducing regulations as a slippery slope, says Brinkley. There are likely various services that nurse practitioners are well qualified to treat, but the board's position is that having that physician oversight is still an important aspect to patient care and safety, she says. To ease restrictions on nurse practitioners would require legislative action. Nursing lobbies have gotten legislation introduced, but none of its bills have made it out of committee. Nurses argue that organizations such as the Medical Board and the Medical Society have stronger lobbying groups with better ties to legislatures, making it difficult for them to see legislation through the General Assembly's chambers. Still, nurses say they are growing more confident about seeing regulations relaxed in the near future, as has happened in many other states throughout the nation. A big push towards that goal is simply education, says Leela Hobson, a nurse practitioner with Jacksonville Children's and Multispecialty Clinic in Jacksonville, North Carolina. She says many people don't really understand the full, broad spectrum of what nurse practitioners can do. We have long been able to take good care of patients. Next up, Campbell's Law Dean will reach out to community. This article is from Chris Bagley. Rich Leonard took over as dean of Campbell University's Law School in mid-July. It's a notable career change for Leonard. Since graduating from Yale University's Law School in 1976, he spent his entire career with federal courts in the Eastern District of North Carolina, except for a 2-year stint at Sanford Adams in Raleigh, a predecessor of Parker Poe. He was a federal bankruptcy judge from 1992 until he joined Campbell. Triangle Business Journal recently caught up with Leonard to discuss his career and his plans as dean. His answers have been condensed. The TBJ asks, Campbell has often argued that its students graduate with the ability to jump right into practice, which is particularly important with lots of unemployed young attorneys out there. What are your goals along those lines? Mr. Leonard replies, our graduates have a very good record of getting law jobs, so one of our top priorities is to make sure we keep doing what we're already doing right. One of those things is our trial advocacy program. Longer term, I'd like to increase the number of legal clinics that we run. Right now we have 2, one for juvenile law and one for elder law. Those might include a clinic for personal bankruptcy, one for immigration, maybe one that helps with small businesses with licensing issues. We could have as many as 10, so for every third-year student, they're out there in the community providing legal services in a specific area. I see Raleigh as a legal laboratory for this school. My job as dean is to go out and find partners in the community who want to make this happen. Law firms, foundations, any donors. Clinics are expensive. There are legitimate American Bar Association requirements for how you have to run it. The TBJ asks, you've been an adjunct professor at Campbell the last few years while still a judge. Can you still sub in as a bankruptcy judge despite being a full-time dean? Mr. Leonard replies, those are called recall judges. After I reach official retirement age in 2 years, I'll be eligible for recall status. I don't see that in the cards right now. If I discover 5 or 10 years from now that I miss it badly, there might be a chance on a limited basis to go back into the courtroom on occasion. TBJ asks, back in the 1990s, a Democratic president nominated you to the 4th Circuit Court of Appeals, and a Republican president nominated Judge Terrence Boyle of the local branch of U.S. District Court to the same court. But both nominations stalled amid opposition from a fairly small number of partisan opponents. Should the system be reformed somehow? Mr. Leonard replies, that's a problem with high-level people misusing their constitutional power. The first judicial act in the new United States specified that the president of the Senate should decide on a day to vote on the same day that someone is nominated. Now we have veto by inaction. Nothing ever happens. People just twist in the wind for years and years and years. I don't think that's the way our tripartite system was intended to function. TBJ asks, activist groups often oppose a nominee because they disagree with the results of some of his or her rulings. Of course, judges usually argue they're merely interpreting the law in ways that prior rulings require them to do. Do you think this just illustrates non-lawyers just not understanding how our legal system works? Mr. Leonard replies, I take my religion and my politics seriously, but I've never found them to be helpful in the courtroom. After attorneys become judges, my experience has been they get nobler. You come on to these courts and you have colleagues who work at such a high level, and you want to hold on to your own and do as good a job. Moving deeper inside this week's Triangle Business Journal, Raleigh's Long Branch Bar files for bankruptcy a second time. The Long Branch, a staple of Raleigh's nightlife on Creekside Drive for 26 years, is once again in bankruptcy. The country music venue off Wake Forest Road has hosted Garth Brooks, Dwight Yoakam, and the regular WQDR broadcast. More recently, in 2008, it found itself in bankruptcy liquidation. A new ownership group, Long Branch of Raleigh, LLC, reopened it in December 2009 and gave it new life with diverse music styles. The club remains open, but the new owners filed for Chapter 11 reorganization on July 29th, citing as much as $130,000 in back rent and assorted other debts. The previous owner group, Long Branch Saloon Enterprises Incorporated, regularly reported annual income of more than $2 million, but its assets were eventually sold off for just $83,000 at the end of its 4-year bankruptcy proceeding. The landlord had begun eviction proceedings on July 29th, and the bankruptcy filing halted a hearing that was scheduled for just a couple of hours later. Like the current owners, the previous ownership group also listed back rent as its leading debt. This week's column by Lauren Onisorge on Infotech, Biotechnology, and Entrepreneurism lists biopharma as it confronts its challenges. Biopharma isn't just an industry with life-saving applications. It's also an industry fueling new jobs in North Carolina. That, along with the importance of education, was the takeaway from a panel discussion of biopharma growth dubbed We Work for NC at GlaxoSmithKline, July 26th. And it's an industry facing challenges that go beyond clinical innovation, challenges in recruitment and regulation. That's why, among the industry guests, leaders such as U.S. Senator Kay Hagan and North Carolina Speaker of the House Tom Tillis made separate appearances. The pair, though they might be running against each other for Hagan's Senate seat someday, say they're on the same team when it comes to promoting the industry. But fostering biotechnology isn't just about state incentives. It's about showcasing North Carolina, not just as a great place to work, but also as a great place to live. Panelist Peter Hare, Senior Vice President and Managing Director of the Customer Solutions Management Group at Quintiles, says the goal is to get a recruit on the phone, mention North Carolina, and get said recruit excited about the state. At the moment, I must say it's a pretty popular place to be, he said, adding that in order to keep it that way, North Carolina needs to stay attractive, particularly with its educational system. John Grinnell, Vice President and Managing Director of the Mead-Westvaco Healthcare, says it's also about directing the education system towards preparing workers for jobs that are available. Even with an 8.8% unemployment rate in the state, his company is at a huge constraint in recruiting qualified employees. It's not just scientists who should be concerned about biotech growth, adds Terry Costello, president of Yonkers Industries. His company works with farmers to build high-tech facilities. As they are running out of product, we are running out of work, he explains. Biotech is a huge part of North Carolina's present and a key part of the future, says panelist Gary Salamindo, vice president of government affairs for the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce. Biopharma by the numbers. Since 1999, 5,428 clinical trials have been conducted by biopharmaceutical companies in collaboration with research institutions in North Carolina, and some are still underway. Of those, 2,597 targeted the most debilitating diseases, which are asthma, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, mental illness, and stroke. This week's spotlight is on the sports business, and this article by Jason DeBruin is entitled Bulls Season to Become Work of Art. The Durham Bulls baseball season is in its final innings, but for a group of documentarians, the heavy lifting for the 2013 Bulls season is just beginning. A group led by Sam Stevenson has been documenting and stockpiling nearly every aspect of the Bulls and the Durham Bulls Athletic Park this season, and will turn their work into an art book and traveling exhibit that will open at the North Carolina Museum of Art in February. Just last week, the team started its transition from collecting photos, videos, and stories to editing their giant portfolios down to the final product. "We can see the finish line," says Stevenson. "We're on the verge of doing something extraordinary." The total project has 16 contributors and guests and a $250,000 budget. The team has raised about half that, largely thanks to sponsoring partners Triangle Orthopedics Associates and Capital Broadcasting Company, the company led by Jim Goodman, who also owns the Bulls. Daylight Books in Hillsboro is the publisher and also has a stake in the project. As the product comes together, Stevenson says he thinks it will be easier to finish out the fundraising goal. "We have some ground to cover," he says, "but the first half is harder than the second half." As publisher for the project, Daylight is closely involved. Company co-founder and CEO Ty Forer says at first he had questions about the broader appeal of a project so closely focused on just one minor league baseball team, but decided that if anyone could give the project broader appeal, it would be Stevenson, who has done that before with projects including the Jazz Loft Project and Dream Street, both of which featured the photography of W. Eugene Smith on very specific topics. Forer says the book will likely be somewhat smaller than a traditional coffee table book, but still big enough to display the photography. At a sales price of less than $50, Forer says it will cost less than a lot of similar books. Next up, debate settles in on cost versus quality of care. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. Healthcare economists largely agree that expanding the role of nurse practitioners in primary care would likely decrease overall healthcare cost, but it could also reduce the level of care that patients receive because nurse practitioners do not go through the same lengthy schooling and residency training as do medical doctors. As the nation continues to search for ways to reduce healthcare spending, considering the cost-benefit of cost versus level of care becomes a factor in the equation. Physicians argue that their time in medical school and residency better prepare them to catch a rare case if they notice something unusual about a patient. That might be true, but the overwhelming majority of primary care visits are for patients with diabetes, high blood pressure, or other relatively routine issues. For a vast majority of these cases, nurse practitioners are equipped and trained to provide the proper care. Dr. Peter Ubel, a medical doctor, behavioral scientist, and a professor of public policy at Duke University, says the same debate can be kicked up a food chain one level. Thyroid specialists, for example, would be better equipped than primary care physicians to catch a rare or specific thyroid illness. But for the majority of patients, primary care physicians can properly diagnose a patient and refer her or him to a specialist if needed, and do it at a lower cost. By presenting to primary care physicians instead of more expensive specialists, patients receive care that is good enough but at less cost. Nurse practitioners make that same argument one step down, saying they can provide care that is good enough and refer to doctors and specialists as needed. For many primary care visits, you don't need 4 years of medical school and 3 years of residency, Ubel says. We could save a lot of money with very little medical harm. Many states have reduced regulations on nurse practitioners, allowing them to fill in primary care gaps. There is no published study that analyzes health outcomes in states with strict nurse regulations against states with looser nurse regulations, partly because eliminating all other variables is nearly impossible. Looking purely at the economics, however, reveals probable savings. By using Texas as a model, Ray Perryman, nationally known economist and CEO of the Waco, Texas-based Perryman Group, estimates immediate savings of $16 billion in the healthcare market by greater use of nurse practitioners and other advanced practice nurses. Elsewhere, a group led by Robin Newhouse, a registered nurse and chairwoman of the Organizational Systems and Adult Health at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, found consistent evidence that cost-related outcomes such as length of stay, emergency visits, and hospitalizations for nurse practitioner care are equivalent to those of physicians. Cost-effectiveness starts with academic preparation. With less schooling and residency training, the American Association of Colleges of Nursing has long estimated that the preparation costs for nurse practitioners are between 20% and 25% of that of physicians. In 2009, for example, the total tuition cost for nurse practitioner preparation was less than the cost of 1 year tuition for medical preparation, according to the association. Similarly, the association reports lower salaries for nurse practitioners. Using data from the American Medical Group Association, total compensation for primary care physicians ranged from $208,658 for a family physician to $219,500 for internal medicine. By contrast, the average full-time salary for nurse practitioners across all types of practice was $97,345, according to the AANP. Especially as more people begin buying health insurance next year under the Affordable Care Act, gaps in primary coverage could grow larger. Physician shortages, particularly in the field of primary care and in rural areas, have been widely predicted for 2 years now. The economic pressures are growing so much that we are at a stage that we are more willing to expand the role of nurse practitioners and advanced practice nurses, says Ubel. For primary care, it's better to see a nurse practitioner next week than wait 3 or 4 weeks to see a primary care physician. And now, Washington Watch by Kent Hoover. Mr. Hoover is the chief of Triangle Business Journal's Washington Bureau. The CBO's take on sequester. Looking for a way to add 900,000 jobs? In the automatic federal spending cuts known as sequestration. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office, which estimates that ending sequestration on August 1st would add 900,000 jobs to the U.S. economy by the third quarter of 2014. Ending sequestration then would increase federal spending by $104 billion through September 30th, 2014, and that would boost real gross domestic product by 0.7%, according to the CBO. The Congressional Budget Office estimates came in response to a request by Representative Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, the ranking Democrat on House Budget Committee. Van Hollen said the report puts a clear price on failure to replace the across-the-board cuts in the sequester. Now that we're winding down on Fannie and Freddie, the House Financial Services Committee approved legislation to wind down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac over 5 years and rely on the private sector to provide a secondary market for residential real estate mortgages. The committee approved the Protecting American Taxpayers and Homeowners Act on a party-line vote after working on the bill for more than 11 hours. Besides winding down Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the PATH or PATH Act would limit the Federal Housing Administration's role in housing finance to first-time homebuyers and people with low and moderate incomes. Republicans contend the legislation will increase competition in the mortgage market and give homebuyers more choices on loan products. Meanwhile, a pharma group that's most effective. The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, better known as PHRMA or PHRMA, is the most effective trade association in Washington, D.C., according to a survey of 456 policy leaders by APCO worldwide. PHRMA ranked number one in the four characteristics that are most important for trade associations: lobbying, multilateral impact, which is working effectively across executive, legislative, and regulatory branches of government, local impact, and membership mobilization. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce ranked number one in coalition building and events. The U.S. Travel Association scored three number one rankings in bipartisanship, industry reputation steward, and media relations. And now, rates on a drag on sale. Pending home sales dropped in June thanks to rising mortgage rates, according to the National Association of Realtors. The organization's Pending Home Sales Index, which is based on contract signings, dipped to 0.4 points to 110.9 in June. The good news is that it's still a strong number, 10.9 points higher than it was a year ago. Plus, May's pending sales were the highest they'd been since December 2006, so a slight drop-off in June was expected. Higher mortgage rates took some momentum out of the market, says NAR chief economist Lawrence Young. The market's persistent lack of inventory also contributed to fewer contract signings. Pending home sales were down in June in the South and Midwest, but up in the West. The Northeast remains unchanged. Next up, Designing Luxury to Suit Owners is Guide to Home Builders Game Plan. This week's Small Business column is about Terramore Homes Incorporated. This article is written by Thompson Wall. Terramore Homes bills itself as an affordable luxury home builder, boasting that it offers homes with a touch, each individually tailored to its homeowner's lifestyle. Terramore, which celebrates its sixth birthday August 7th, opened its doors in 2007 at the tipping point of the U.S. housing bubble when many banks were unwilling to offer construction loans. A great time to start a building company, Terramore President Pablo Ryder joshes. But it turns out, fine, we're still here. The company came out of the harsh real estate climate and has since built nearly 120 homes each year in nearly 20 luxury communities across the Triangle, including the Hamptons at Umstead, Raleigh's Bedford Estates, Heritage in Wake Forest, and Highcroft Village in Cary. Though the competition is stiff, COO Michelle Sims and Ryder agree that the market is big enough for everyone. Right now, there are enough customers to go around, Ryder says. Now that the market is really coming back in the past 12 months, we actually have had a shortage of labor. With the price of building materials now rising again and the Triangle real estate market approaching pre-recession levels in terms of new home sales, Sims says a perception of what a luxury home should include is evolving. Everyone wants a combination huge kitchen and family area with no break in between, and that's not the way homes were built even 5 years ago, Sims says. The design of our homes is clearly different, Ryder said. Michelle has designed every single one of these homes. She's scouring design ideas and magazines to get what the wife is looking for. In 2012, the company became the first builder to enter an eco-home qualified home, six of them for that matter, into the annual Wake County Parade of Homes. Southern Energy Management, SEM, a longtime partner in the Energy Star program, created EcoHome for builders looking for a program to improve the health, comfort, and energy efficiency of their homes. Terramore later pledged to build all new homes according to the EcoHome standard, which means each home will be at least 25% more efficient than new code-built homes. The partners at Terramore Homes also want to give back to the community. Terramore has been selected as the builder of the 2014 Mix 101.5 WRAL Radiothon Miracle Home to benefit Duke Children's Hospital. Priced at $725,000, the five-bedroom, 5.5-bathroom home will boast 5,669 square feet and is currently under construction on McGalloway Street and Cary's Cameron Pond community. The home will be move-in ready by this year's Parade of Homes in October. Terramore has pledged to raise $120,000 for the Miracle Home in addition to proceeds from the home sale, which will be donated to Duke Children's Hospital and Health Care Center. Sims and Ryder say the proceeds will go towards the hospital's research and development fund, as well as securing doctors and upgraded technology. Proceeds will also allow children to attend Camp Kaleidoscope, a residential camp for children treated at Duke Children's Hospital, who would otherwise be unable to attend camp for illness-related reasons. Having been at the Children's Hospital during the Radiothon this past year and learning where this money goes, there's never enough you can do, Sims says. This week's Legal Focus column is by Mr. Jim Verdonik. Mr. Verdonik is an attorney with Ward & Smith in Raleigh and the operator of eLearnSuccess.com. This week's column is entitled, When Fraud Occurs Within Bowels of Government. What's the hottest thing in securities fraud? Rich investment bankers selling financially engineered swaps to institutional investors? Con men selling guaranteed high returns to widows and orphans? How about Nigerian princes selling oil deals via email? No, your local city hall is the hottest thing in securities fraud. Earlier this year, the Securities and Exchange Commission charged both the cities of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Miami, Florida, with securities fraud. With Detroit recently filing a $20 billion bankruptcy, municipal bond fraud is hitting the big time. It's time to expect investor lawsuits. How does a city commit securities fraud? It's always been clear that misstatements or omissions of material facts in the disclosure of documents that cities give investors when they sell bonds are instances of securities fraud. But now the SEC is going after cities for misstatements and omissions that officials make outside their formal disclosure documents. Most lawsuits against big publicly traded corporations are for misstatements or omissions in press releases or ongoing disclosures, not in the registration statements they file with the SEC when they sell securities to the public. These ongoing misstatements and omissions mislead investors who are trading securities with other investors. Likewise, investors trade the bonds that governments sell. So governments also have ongoing obligations not to mislead investors by misstating or hiding material facts. What types of omissions and misrepresentations did Harrisburg and Miami make? Harrisburg allegedly stopped providing information about his finances to the public by not disclosing audited financial statements. Harrisburg also lied on its website to hide its deteriorating financial conditions. Miami allegedly played shell games with municipal bank accounts by transferring $37.5 million from its capital account to its operating budget to fool people into thinking its operating budget was balanced. These misrepresentations allowed Miami to obtain a higher credit rating from the rating agencies, and that reduced the interest Miami had to pay investors. We're all used to your typical government website or press release accentuating the positives. But accentuating the positives without disclosing the related negatives is how people usually violate securities laws. After a few more prosecutions by the SEC and investor lawsuits, maybe we'll start seeing government websites and press releases present more balanced pictures of what is happening. Such as, the city revitalized downtown while potholes spread all over town. Or, the state increased teacher salaries while test scores stagnated. Or, we lowered the town's unemployment rate by giving city jobs to the mayor's family. Or, we balanced the city's budget by postponing water main repairs that won't leak until our current mayor retires. Or, crime rates decreased because we increased waiting times to answer telephones, and frustrated people stopped reporting crimes. Check out your federal, state, and local government websites. How are they doing at complying with securities laws? The Constitution's First Amendment protects the right of politicians to mislead voters in elections, but security laws protect investors from government officials lying or hiding material facts. So the next time you ask a government official a question, don't say you are a voter, say you are a bondholder. You might get a more truthful answer. By the way, challengers remain free to mislead you in election campaigns. Only incumbent officials are subject to securities laws. This week's viewpoint for the Triangle Business Journal is entitled Tales from the North Carolina General Assembly. North Carolina lawmakers wrapped up their long session in the past week, and from a business person's perspective, was this a good session? Here are two opposing views from local observers. The first viewpoint is from Mr. Fitzsimmons, who is the director of North Carolina Policy Watch, a project of the North Carolina Justice Center. His column is entitled, Businesses Should Worry About Education Cuts. Many small businesses in North Carolina will have a higher tax bill next year thanks to the 2013 session of the General Assembly. Many large multi-state corporations based outside North Carolina will pay less in state taxes. If you care only about the absolute bottom line for business, that's what happened this session. Small companies will pay more, larger corporations will pay less. The tax shift plan, it's not tax reform, ended a small business tax cut created in 2011 and instead lowered the state corporate income tax, which is primarily paid by larger out-of-state companies. The tax plan also gives wealthy individuals a big break and raises taxes on most low and moderate income taxpayers as it eliminates the state earned income tax credit that helped 900,000 wage workers in 2011, including 64,000 military families. Those are the facts, though they are hard to find sometimes in the blizzard of political spin that follows any session of the General Assembly. But most business leaders care about far more than their tax bill, and that's where this General Assembly fell even further short. Surveys of business leaders consistently show that they care deeply about the quality of the state's workforce and the quality of life for their employees when making a decision about where to locate or expand their business. The budget adopted by state lawmakers and signed into law by Governor Pat McCrory slashes $480 million in overall education funding from the amount the state budget office said was needed to keep services at the same level as last year. North Carolina now ranks almost at the bottom of the 50 states in per pupil spending on public education and teacher pay. A teacher in North Carolina must work 15 years to make a $40,000 salary. Business leaders know that doesn't make sense if we're trying to attract and keep the most qualified teachers in the classroom. The university system, one of the state's most important economic engines and long considered its crown jewel, had its funding slashed again this summer, and has now had to absorb almost $1 billion in cuts in the last several years. That hurts students, families, and economic development. Enlightened business leaders also know that their success is closely tied to the success of their communities. This session not only brought education cuts and a tax shift that penalizes small businesses and middle-class families, but lawmakers also pursued a polarizing agenda that includes sweeping new restrictions on women's reproductive rights and a host of measures that will make it difficult for hundreds of thousands of people to vote. The opposing view for this week is from Mr. John Hood. Mr. Hood is the president of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. His column is entitled, Session Good for Business. During the tumultuous legislative sessions of the past 3 years, the left and right inside and outside government have presented different answers to two related questions about North Carolina's business climate. First, is it good or bad? Second, what would make it better? On the first question, most North Carolinians clearly agree with fiscal conservatives about the state's economic competitiveness. They think it needs major improvement, and they're right. Sure, by throwing ever-increasing amounts of corporate welfare at a few targeted firms, North Carolina has managed to rank highly on some business indices to popular with professional recruiters. But according to the standard measures of actual economic performance, such as growth in per capita GDP and employment, North Carolina has lagged the regional and national averages since the late 1990s. Adjusting for inflation, per capita incomes are lower in North Carolina today than they were a decade ago. Our unemployment rate remains stubbornly high, and the 10 largest states in the Union, only Illinois has a weaker labor market. It's hard to argue with these facts. Still, North Carolina liberals and the Democrats who ran the legislature until 2011 gave it a good college try. Unfortunately for them, the public never bought it. So now liberals are arguing that the mix of fiscal and regulatory reforms the Republican-led legislature and Governor Pat McCrory enacted in 2013 will make the state's climate for business worse. They're wrong about that, too. The preponderance of scholarly research on the topic suggests that while national and international factors exercise the greatest influence on state economic performance, state policymakers can boost job and income growth if they, one, provide valuable public services such as public safety, roads, and schools at an economical price, two, keep tax rates as low as possible, particularly on the capital formation, and three, impose regulations only when their benefits are clearly greater than their costs. These are precisely the policies that McCrory and legislative Republicans have put into place this year. When fully implemented, their tax reform package gives North Carolina a flat income tax of 5.75% and a corporate tax of 3%. Compared with the previous top tax rates of 7.75% and 6.9% respectively, these tax rates will encourage investors, business executives, entrepreneurs, and professionals to put more financial and human capital to work in North Carolina, which will increase private employment and personal incomes. At the same time, legislatures passed a sweeping regulatory reform bill that will subject all existing rules to periodic review. Regulations that don't survive review will automatically disappear. They also rewrote the state's funding formula for transportation, which will alleviate congestion and give the circulatory system of North Carolina's economy a major boost. On workforce development, lawmakers strengthened vocational education, changed hiring and compensation policies to encourage higher quality teaching, gave parents and students more choices among competing education providers, and targeted the greater share of new education spending, a 5% increase in authorized spending in fiscal year 2013-14, to elementary and secondary education, rather than giving preferential treatment to the UNC system as past legislatures have done. The common denominator here is investment. The legislature used tax and regulatory reforms to encourage more private investment in North Carolina, while using transportation and education reforms to increase productivity of public investment. Most lawmakers understand that keeping taxes high to subsidize public consumption, such as excessive Medicaid spending, is a strategy for continued economic weakness. In short, McCrory and the conservative leaders of the legislature have correctly diagnosed North Carolina's economic maladies and prescribed the right course of treatment for them. Of course, there is political opposition. It comes primarily from those public employees and private interests who prefer the status quo to fundamental change. Their discomfort is understandable, but for most North Carolinians, the status quo in economic policy wasn't working. They voted for change. They got it. Tier Science scores a win with a device. Morrisville medical device company Tier Science has expanded farther into Japan. The company, helmed by CEO Tim Willis, says the Shinagawa LASIK and Eye Center in Japan has purchased its dry eye relief system to be offered at 8 of its eye care clinics in that country. The deal came after success in implementing the system at Shinagawa's Tokyo Clinic. And it's bigger news than it initially appears to be. Shinagawa has performed more than 1.2 million LASIK procedures as of August 31, 2012. That's the highest number of such procedures performed at any ophthalmic center globally, meaning a lot of visibility for this triangle company. Also, UNC Chapel Hill's new chief creates a high-level public relations position. Perhaps paying attention to the flack endured by her predecessor, UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Carol Fault has created a new position at the vice chancellor level to oversee public relations. The Daily Tar Heel reports that Fault created the position of vice chancellor for communications and public affairs after having discussions with former Chancellor Holden Thorpe, who endured a massive scandal involving both athletics and academics before deciding to move on to a different university and a different job. The person chosen for the new position will be responsible for managing all of UNC's public relations and affairs with oversight of various PR offices on campus. Fault told the Daily Tar Heel she doesn't consider the new VC's job to be one of playing defense for the university. "I look at this more proactively," she says. "We've got to get information out faster, quicker, and more strategically." Meanwhile, Epic goes to war. Tan Hutt, plug in the game and prep for war. Virginia IT integrator Intelligent Decisions has licensed Epic Games development technology Unreal Engine 3 to produce 3D training technology and simulation content as part of a contract with the United States Army. The ultimate goal is to create a realistic training environment for soldiers. Unreal Engine 3 will give IDs training scenarios composers the ability to integrate an incoming fire haptic feedback system, full skeletal controls, and to customize terrain, weather, enemy forces, and other treacherous aspects of real-life combat missions, says Clarence Pape, Intelligence Decisions Vice President. Ladies in Holly Springs are in the brew. You go, girls. Holly Springs will soon become the home of an all-female-owned microbrewery that aims to prove craft beer is not just for guys. Bombshell Beer Company, founded by co-owners Michelle Minuti, Ellen Joyner, and Jackie Hudspeth, have been in the works since 2012 and is slated to open in September. Located at 120 Quantum Drive within Holly Springs Omni Business Park, the 5,840-square-foot building will house a production brewery, lab, and a 1,400-square-foot tasting room. The space is nearing completion and is expected to have seating for 90. The brewery will feature a 15-barrel steam-fired brew house manufactured by SMT Food and Beverage Systems of Stokesdale. The trio has hired Stephen O'Neill, formerly of Church Brew Works in Pittsburgh, as the company's head brewer. Beers will include a selection of pilsners, pale ales, IPAs, and porters, along with assorted specialty beers. Also, Prometheus Group gets a cash jolt. Boston-based TA Associates has completed a minority recapitalization of Prometheus Group, a Raleigh-based enterprise application software company. Terms of the investment were not disclosed. Prometheus serves a true marketplace need, helping companies more efficiently and effectively utilize EAM software solutions, says Ashutas Agrawal, a principal at TA Associates who will join the Prometheus board. Eric Huang, founder and CEO of Prometheus, says the experience TA brings is a welcome addition. TA will play a central role in our efforts to broaden adoption of our products along existing clients and expand into new markets, he says. Also, you should know that Clyde Cooper's Barbecue Restaurant is looking to make a new home for itself in downtown Raleigh. Even though the century-old home to Clyde Cooper's Barbecue Restaurant is going away, the iconic eatery's owners are doing everything in their power to make their new space into an exact replica. The downtown Raleigh restaurant's owners plan to take everything and the kitchen sink, quite literally, from the old space in 109 East Davy Street and incorporated it into the new one at 331 South Wilmington Street. Debbie and Ryan Holt are the restaurant's third owners in a line of management dating back to the original Mr. Cooper in 1937. The restaurant's future digs on South Wilmington Street are only a few steps away from the 1884 building that has housed the restaurant since January 1, 1938. You should also know that Delta Airlines is beginning nonstop weekly service to the Bahamas from Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The airport said this past Tuesday. The flight leaves Nassau each Saturday morning at 11:40, starting December 21st. It lands at RDU at 2:10 p.m. and takes off again at 2:40 p.m. The flight to Nassau will be RDU's fourth international flight, joining an American Airlines flight to London, an Air Canada flight to Toronto, and a seasonal Delta flight to Cancun. Vision Airlines and Bahama Air briefly offered nonstop service to Freeport on Grand Bahama Island in 2011 and 2012. Anstock Building Company, the Raleigh-based materials company that was bought out by a private equity investor and then put through bankruptcy in 2009, has put a value of more than $400 million on itself as it once again goes public. The company foresees an IPO value of $16 to $18 a share, according to a document it filed today with the federal securities regulators. That translates into a total market value of $409.3 million to $460.4 million, given the 25.6 million shares of common stock that will be outstanding following the IPO. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.